Accession number 22621, Reel 2.
John Adams, Reel 2.
He came into the billet and he was a very small boy. He shouldn't have been in the army at all, really. And he put his kit down and went to battery headquarters, and when he come back his kit had gone and they'd pinched it. And he used to come under, from that place we were at, Tow Law, we used to go to the baths at one of the mining towns nearby. It wasn't an awful long way, maybe 12 miles away, and we used to march there and come back on the truck. And if you marched there, if you went on the truck, you marched back, vice versa, you see. But this little lad, I mean, we were all fairly tallish and marching along, but his little legs wouldn't take him. He was nearly running to keep up. I felt real sorry for him. I don't know what happened to him. They got rid of him, I think, in the end.
You said there was a different type of bloke in this battery as compared with the other one, but were they of a similar military efficiency, or was one superior to the other?
Well, they changed a lot. You see, we didn't keep that major very long. Before, during the same year, he was a first World War soldier, you see. He'd be getting on a bit, the major. And we got another one. But we didn't keep him very long either. It wasn't a terribly military unit. It was a very easygoing unit, really.
How did you get on at Tow Law?
Oh, pretty good, pretty good. It was there that, I was promoted from the old battery. They promoted Mr. Bombardier and posted me. I'd seen the sergeant major and said I didn't want to leave the battery because all my friends were there. And anyhow, he said, I'll take you to see the major. I saw him in the battery office and he said, look, he posted you, an army tradesman. And if you're still here on these premises in half an hour's time, I shall have to put you on a charge. So I got all my gear together and there's all my pals grouped round me. The one at this side sewing my stripes on and one at this side sewing them on. And of course, that was it, I went. But I became as fond of the new battery in time because by the end of the war I'd served longer with that battery than with the first one. And of course, there aren't very many people who can say they served in the same regiment right throughout the war, really. Because most of the intakes we got thereafter, they'd all come direct from training regiments. And I never saw the inside of a training regiment at all.
Before we take you abroad, were there any other incidents that happened to you whilst you were in this country?
Well, just before the Battle of Britain time, we went down to Lambourne in the racing area, you know, and we built in a big house there. And it was from there that I got posted on a course to the Royal Military School of Artillery, and they sent me on a week's leave first, and they had to report back to Ashford. Well, that's all it put on the pass, report to Ashford on completion of leave. And when I got home, my father, being a man from Kent, I asked him if there was an Ashford in Kent, and he said yes, but he said there's several Ashfords down south, and he said you'd better find out which one it is. So I had to go to the East Yorkshire Regiment down in Hull, and I had to ask them to find out if they could find out where I was going, you see, which they did. And it was Ashford, Kent. But when I got there, I mean, I had to find my way about, I was a bit late on parade next morning to report in. And because while I'd been on leave, I'd been and got a haircut, and so far as I know, I mean, everything was in apple pie order, but it was a regimental place, was this, It was a regular army unit, and I was late on parade because I couldn't find the place. And then he looked at me and said, "You haven't shaved this morning, your boots are dirty, your kit's dirty, and you need a haircut." So I was on the charge there. I had to do a guard for about 6 nights. But by the time I finished there, they used me as an example. They got me in front of the parade and they said, "We want you all to look like this man. He's smart, you see." So that's about all I can remember there. But we didn't stay at Ashford long because...
Was this where you were doing the course?
Yes, yes.
The artillery course?
Yes, Royal... What?
Was that the School of Artillery?
The Royal School of Military Science, I think it was, something like that.
What did you learn there?
Oh, we learned all about the guns, everything, but the only trouble was they hadn't a modern gun in the place. I mean, there was for instance, the biggest gun they had there was a 9.2 howitzer, a First World War siege gun. And it had a crew of about 60, and they had to load the shell on with a crane and the charge. And it was real hard work, really. But we could have handled it if we'd had to. And more on the mechanical side to maintain it. And I remember once was a sergeant there, and I was still a gunner then at that time. One of the lads, the sergeant sitting in the crane was there, and he got the handle and he moved the crane near the sergeant's head. And then he said, "Hey, sergeant," and he turned his head and bumped his head on the crane. Of course, we all thought that was funny. But we had schooling there as well, of course. We did schoolroom stuff as well. And the other guns, there was a 60-pounder, likewise from the First World War. And a 4.5 howitzer. And one of those mountain howitzers, which took them to bits and didn't unpack them. Well, we did training on all those, and we knew everything about them, you know. And for the practical test, I came out top, but not with the theory.
Why did you have to learn about all these different varieties of artillery piece if you were just on 6-pounders?
Well, there weren't any 6-pounders then to train us on. They didn't have any. There wasn't even a 2-pounder there. That's the only guns they had available. And of course, when... Dunkirk got cracking, they moved us from there. We had to pack the whole lot up. They were all set up in old cinemas, you know, these guns. And we had to move to Stoke-on-Trent. I was billeted at Hanley on Stoke-on-Trent. And it extended the course. I was away from the battery for another 6 months, I think.
Did you see anything of the men returning from Dunkirk?
Yes, oh yes. Before we moved from Ashford, they were passing through Ashford and they were stopping at the station, and people were plying them with drinks and oranges, apples, sandwiches and everything, you know. And they looked in a very sorry state indeed.
In what way?
Why, unkempt, unshaven, you know. They won't be able to shave there on the beaches, I shouldn't think. They were very, very scruffy.
Did you think at that time the Germans might win the war?
Well, no, I don't think we ever did. We never gave it a thought. We caught the train from the same station when we'd moved all our guns and everything and followed them along. No, we could hear the guns from France at the time.
In Ashford?
Yes, Ashford, yes. Well, when you look as the crow flies, it's not very, very far.
Now, can you tell me about the procedure for going abroad, please?
Well, they moved us near to... what was the place? Near Glasgow.
You mean a port?
It was near port in Glasgow. Mm-hmm.
Gourock or Greenock?
Well, Greenock was the name mentioned, but we weren't actually at Greenock. It's funny how things go together.
Don't mind the name. Never mind the name, it might come back to you. Just tell me what happened, please.
Well, as soon as we got wind that we were going abroad, we didn't know where we were going. That was just another posting for us. But the battery clerk, he had inside information, and he and several others, they took themselves home on leave. The battery clerk came from Carlisle, so a lot of them went absent without leave to go to Glasgow and different places round about. Of course, he was a sergeant at the time, but when he came back, he was demoted to corporal, bombardier. And one sergeant lost his stripes altogether, and they sent him abroad first with the first wave. We didn't go in the first wave, we went in the second. And he was killed early doors because he was riding a motorcycle with the adjutant on the pillion, and they run into some machine gun fire and they were both killed. I saw the motorbike when we got to North Africa, and when we sailed they put us on a train and took us to the docks, and somehow or other some Pioneer Corps chaps who had been going on leave had got on the wrong train, so they wouldn't let them go, they had to go on the boat and go with us. It was hard lines on them for security reasons. And when we set sail, it took us 10 days to get to North Africa, and we didn't know where we were going even at that stage, because we sailed straight across in, you know, the Atlantic. We come to the conclusion, well, we must be going to America, I don't know why. And we did an about turn in mid-Atlantic and headed back. We could tell by the sun when it turned and everything. And we had some of the most dreadful weather, you know, even the crew of the ship could remember. And I'd never been seasick in my life, and I wasn't there. On the mess deck, we sat at really long tables that stretched from one side of the ship to the others. And it was pitching and tossing and rolling, and there was a funny sort of a circular motion as well. And when the ship plunged to port, I remember he had a mug of tea one meal time, and it slid right up to the end of the table. Then when it plunged the other way, it comes sliding back. But the chaps were rolling about in the scuppers, you know, seasick, absolutely.
Do you know the name of the ship?
Cameronia. And I never knew what happened to it later, because when I'd never been seasick, of course, there's only myself and the battery clerk at the table who hadn't been seasick, therefore we had choice good food, you know, they get good food on ships. Nobody else could eat anything, but we did ourselves proud. And with the rough seas, on the troop ship, they used to take all the weapons off people, because some people got so miserable with seasickness, they shot themselves, you know, especially Indians. So they stored all the rifles in the forepeak. Do you know the forepeak of a ship? And they all broke loose, so I had to take a squad of blokes down there to secure them. And I was on the sort of a bridge thing in front, and
and then?
There were plenty of rope, so I run down the steps, and when the ship plunged one way, I tied a rope around part of the framework the rifles were clipped into, and I run back up the steps before they come back and caught me, and got the lads to pull the rope until they got them tight, and then secured them somewhere. And I kept doing that until everything was absolutely secure. But the lads were grumbling because they'd got over the first phase of seasickness, and they're all getting seasick again. Because it's difficult keeping your feet on those ships, you know, in rough weather like that. I went out on deck one day, you weren't supposed to go on deck. And one minute you could see, on the crest of a wave, you could see every ship in the convoy. And when you were in the trough, all you could see was a wall of water around the ship. I was lucky I didn't get washed overboard, really. Then, of course, they had the destroyer escorts. And they're used to run up and down the sides of the convoy like sheepdogs after sheep. And they'd be using loudhailers, telling the Cameronia, you're too far out, close in. You're too far behind, catch up, and all that sort of stuff. And one day we saw them firing depth charges. So there must have been a submarine about somewhere. Because I thought submarines couldn't operate in rough seas like that, but they can apparently. And when we got back, we went through the Straits of Gibraltar, of course, and into the calm of the Mediterranean, out of the rough Atlantic, and the ship was still pitching and tossing and rolling for ages in the calm water with the momentum. And of course, we put in Algiers with the. Have you got it all?
Yes.
We put in at Algiers, and they wouldn't let us land. There was some trouble with the French there, so we had to stay below decks, and they were firing at the ship, you see. So about midnight, we put to sea again to go to Bourne, the port of Bourne, and we hadn't been on the voyage for very long when we came under attack from Italian torpedo carrying planes, and it went on all night. And then it must have been the last plane, just as dawn was breaking, that hit us. It hit deck 9, and we were on deck 8. And there was a terrific smell of cordite and explosives, you know. And the ship, the heave to, you know, stopped. And we didn't know what was happening. We all had to make for the boat stations. And you know, they made us put our greatcoats on. We couldn't take our boots off. But on top of all that lot, we put our Mae West on. And I said to one of the pals, I said, this won't keep us afloat. We'll sink like stones if we go overboard. And I think that was the idea, perhaps. However, the ship didn't sink there. It put into Bourne, which it was within sight of the coast. I would think about 20 miles. And we got into the port, and then the next day, when we went to have a look, the ship had settled down on the bottom. But there was about 90 men killed in the attack. Wiped out the 17th Field Regiment, just about.
Was it a frightening experience?
Well, it was a bit apprehensive, but I didn't see anybody panicking or anything. We'd done the boat drill every day, you see, and I remember I took a hand running the naffy at one stage because people got fed up with it. And there's a great big corridor right through the ship and a real thick rope. And there's one man somehow, he'd got his foot in a loop in this rope, and the rope was going through the ship, and he was yelling his head off, hopping along. I don't know how he got out of it, because the rope was disappearing down the hole at the rear of the ship, you see, at the stern.
So you didn't see the outcome?
I don't know what happened to the Cameronia.
I mean the outcome for this man?
Oh, no. I think he must have got away with it all right. But I should think the rope would be too thick to go through the hole, perhaps. But
what are your next memories?
Well, they put us ashore at Bourne, near the docks, but every day the Stukas came over dive bombing us, so they had to move us out. And I remember they put us in a great big marquee within sight of the docks, and every morning the Stukas used to come down and bomb it.
This is at Bourne?
Pardon?
At Bourne?
At Bourne, yeah. Bouguer. This was just before Christmas. We sailed. We sailed on the 10th of December, and we got there on the 20th. It took us 10 days to get there. And I remember just before New Year, they gave me a squad of blokes. Mind, it was a Scottish regiment. And on New Year's Eve, I had to take the squad to the docks, unloading ammunition. And when we got there, the officer there said, pointed out the trucks we had to load. He said, when you've got them loaded, you're finished, you can go back to your unit. So these lads wanted to get back because they had a New Year's Eve party laid on the back at the battery. And, of course, I reported to this officer. I said, we've loaded all our trucks now, sir. Can we get away? No, the others haven't done so well as you. You can give them on to load theirs. And the upshot was that when we got to the battery, the party had finished. It was the early hours. And they'd left us an orange and an apple and a bottle of beer each.
So was the Cameronia torpedoed off Bone or off Bougie?
Off Bougie.
Not Bone.
Not Bone. No, I'll come to Bone in a minute. That was the original destination. So they chose Christmas Day to get us to Bone. It was the ship we went on was a former ferry between Scotland and Ireland. I forget what the name of it was, but it had been taken over by the Royal Navy. And for Christmas dinner on that voyage, we got bully beef and biscuits. And they could spare us a little bit of Christmas pudding. But even then, when we got to Bone, we didn't have our guns hadn't arrived. They were coming on another ship.
So you moved by land from Bougie to Bone?
No, by sea. On this ferry, naval ship. That's, I say, we had our Christmas dinner on board the ship, such as it was.
What's happened to you once you got to Bone?
Well, it was raining. More rain than you'd expect, really, in North Africa. We were absolutely wet through. And initially, we were able to shelter in the sheds on the docks, you see. But they had to move us out from there. And they took us in the field. Well, what went for a field in North Africa. And to keep dry, well, we couldn't keep dry, but at night time, when we went to sleep, we had to stand up on the tarpaulin, wrap our blankets round us, get all the tarpaulin and lie down and pull it right over our heads. All the lot of us in a row. But we slept all right. But we went through just the same.
How had the local people reacted to you?
Well, the only people we saw were Arabs, apart from French North African troops. And they seemed all right. They didn't seem to show any objections at all or anything.
And then?
Well, we were stuck there for about, I should think, a week, maybe 2 weeks before we got our equipment. And then when we did get it, we moved up to a place called Bija.
When you say the equipment, you mean the 6-pounders?
Yes, yes. And the trucks and everything, stores wagons and motorbikes.
What's happened to you at Bija?
Pardon?
What's happened to you at Bija?
Well, we were on our way to the front then. They moved on almost immediately, the battery, and they moved on to a place called Medjez El Bab, which you may be heard of.
Yes.
And they put the guns in position, but I had to stay behind because the quarter blocks truck hadn't arrived. And I'm afraid the quartermaster sergeant at that time, he was the same sergeant who met us when I got called up in Glasgow. And he wasn't very brave. And when it didn't come at all, we decided to go on. And he got on our pillion, riding along the road, and no lights on, of course, and we heard voices coming from overhead. So I turned, there was a track leading, so I rode down it, seeing we got off. And they turned out to be French Moroccan troops, Lagoons, I think they called them. And they couldn't speak English or anything, so we came back. And, well, I rode the motorbike back to the main road slowly. And he thought I was leaving him, and he was going frantic, wait for me, wait for me.
Was he frightened of the goons?
Yeah, he didn't know what they were, it might have been Germans. And anyhow, he got on the motorbike again on the pillion, and we got continued down the road. And there's a great big pile of sand and gravel at the edge of the road, and I run right into it, and we both come off. And that frightened him still further. Anyhow, he eventually got to Medjez El Bab. It was about 30 miles from Bija. And as we got nearer the front, we could hear the guns firing, you know, above the sound of the motorbike. And 25 pounders, of course, ours. And there was nobody about when we got there, so I could see our trucks and things in the farmyard, so there was a farmyard cart there, and I looked, oh, I thought, that's a good place to sleep, because it was covered with fur or something, you know. So I rolled my blankets out and got down to it and went to sleep. And when I woke up in the morning, I'd been sleeping on a cart full of uncured animal skins, and it didn't half stink. So that was my first experience of frontline thing. Then, of course, the mood was right into Medjez El Bab in the centre. And they only stayed there a day or two because it was under constant mortar and shell fire, you see, because it's very near to where the Germans were, the Longstop Hill and all that, you know. So the mood was off down a mile down the road to a little railway hut. And we billeted there, you see, but things got so bad that we couldn't leave the area in daylight because the Germans, they had the airport at Tunis, and we were under constant attack from the air. Every time anybody went out on the road, they were under attack, so we had to stay put. They shot a chap off a telegraph pole, and we were repairing it. And it was from there when the Americans got into trouble at Gafsa. Will you have heard about that?
I've heard of Gafsa.
Mm.
What happened?
Well, we don't know. I've read accounts about it, and I still don't know what exactly happened.
Well, let's stick to the things that you personally had
experienced. But the story going round at the time was that the Americans retired for the night, and they never left any guards on anything, and the Germans just moved in and pinched all the stores, took them prisoner, and
what's happened to you next?
Well, our division, our brigade, they were ordered down to Gafsa to, you know, to steady up the position, and we didn't know what was going on at the time because I'd got so fed up with doing nothing, I thought I'll decarbonise my motorbike. So I took the petrol tank off, cylinder head, valves out, and grinding the valves in. And we got the order to be ready to move in half an hour because 10 minutes after we moved, the Germans would begin. We were evacuating the area. So one of my pals with the motorbike stayed, and I've never put a motorbike together so quickly in my life. Put the valves back and everything, and gave it a kick, and it started first time, so we were off down the road. The only trouble was we had to go a mile down the road into Medjez El Bab in the direction from which the Germans would be coming, and turn right at the bottom along the main road and down another road which led to Gafsa eventually at not quite right angles to the one we were leaving. And of course we travelled all day and all night. And during that time, I actually went to sleep on the motorbike and finished up in cactus-strewn scrubland. But fortunately, I woke up and I never come off. But we were so tired when we got to the area of Gafsa that we all put our blankets down and got down to it. But it was too late because they came over and raided the place, you know, and dropping bombs. So we didn't get any rest at all. And the major said, you'd better camouflage all you vehicles and everything. So it was a chalk quarry we were in, and I smashed up a lot of...